I'm Eddie Merckx. You listen to the Bicycle Show on Resonance 104.4 FM.
Welcome to the Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. Now, a few weeks ago, Kieran Yates and I shone a spotlight on the little-known world of long-distance cycling, a world that's known in the UK as Audax and in other parts of the world as randonneuring. After we'd talked about the challenges of ultra-long-distance riding, I asked you to write in with your stories of having set an ambitious target for a long-distance ride and to tell me how you got on. Well, a few people did get in touch, thank you. But one email stands out above the rest, and I'm going to read that out in full. It's from John Spencer. And John writes, I grew up in a cycling family, and around the traditional UK cycling club time trial scene, Audax was something I'd heard of, but that somehow seemed completely unfeasible. Surely a 600-kilometre bike ride was just a shaggy dog story. Well, in late 2012, I hooked up with a group of Audax-minded chaps in Portsmouth and started joining them on their regular midweek pub runs. One thing led to another, and in October 2012, I was signed up to ride my first 200-kilometre ride. This ride, the Wylie and Ebble Valley 200, took me from Denmead near Portsmouth on a giant loop around Salisbury and back through the New Forest. At the end, in fact, well before the end, I was truly shattered, shivering, exhausted, and unable to comprehend riding my bike anymore. Before doing this ride, I'd ridden over 100 miles, maybe three times, but not for many years. However, as I recovered, I kept reflecting on what a fantastic ride it had been and how many new lanes and hidden places I'd seen. Over the next few Wednesdays, I was persuaded not just to ride another Audax, but to sign up for a whole super randonneur series comprising a 200-kilometre, 300-kilometre, 400-kilometre and 600-kilometre ride. Apparently, the Wessex series of rides was back on the calendar for 2013, and I was assured that this was an unmissable challenge. These rides were news to me, but were spoken of in hushed and reverent tones by the others. As a Dorset boy, I was easily sold. A super randonneur series in the backyard I'd never really explored properly. The rides were completed between April and June 2013. The greatest challenge was the first weekend, starting at 2 a.m. on the Saturday for the hard-boiled 300, with the Dorset Coast 200 the very next day. On the first section of the hard-boiled, our water bottles froze solid, and it was a truly gruelling ride. There were 4,500 metres of climbing, and it was all the short, steep, vicious climbs which abound in the area. Most of the climbing was in the last 100 kilometres, which was beyond description. Arriving at the finish at 8 p.m, I had to be cajoled and subject to excruciating peer pressure before I agreed to start the 200-kilometre Dorset Coast at 7 a.m. the next day. That, I suspect, was a truly gorgeous ride. But not if you've done a 300 the day before. The Porkers 400 in May is where it all started to make sense. This is a challenging ride with countless steep Dorset, Devon, Wiltshire and Somerset hills making up around 6,000 metres of climbing. It was also just beautiful. The hard rides earlier had brought condition to my legs and I was able to really enjoy the scenery. On any bike ride, it takes a while to leave real life behind and relax into the ride. On a two-hour ride, you might not be able to do this at all. On a 400-kilometre ride, there is breathing space. Riding through the night starts to make sense. At 2 a.m, on top of a high hill, the stars really shine. It's inevitable that riding through the night will bring physical and mental lows, but get through this, and riding into the dawn can be very special indeed. The high moment of the series for me was climbing Bull Barrow, one of Dorset's real brutes, in the pre-dawn light. The light had a warm quality that promised a great day, and the lowlands of Dorset were shrouded in mist, and the many hilltops made a sort of mystical archipelago. A bright dawn broke as we crested the hill, and for my ride buddy Pete and I, it was a special moment indeed. The series concluded in June with the Brimstone 600. This was as hard as the name suggests, nearly 8,000 metres of climbing between Poole, Andover, Exmouth, Cheddar, Malmesbury, Frome, and back to Poole, and a joyous experience. The feeling of triumph at the end of this ride and the end of the series was something I'd never experienced before. This was a challenge I was never sure I'd complete right up until the end. The best part was that every rider I saw on the road was sharing the ride. Nobody was trying to beat me, and I wasn't trying to beat anyone else. We were all trying to beat the course and the clock, and we were united in our effort. It was a special feeling. Reflecting on the rides now, I almost have a tear in my eye. Sure, I suffered, but that was just a part of climbing the highest highs I've ever had on a bike. I think every cyclist can and should do this. Well, thanks, John. Terrific account of your Super Randonneur series, really inspiring. We now turn from the joy of riding a bike a very long way to the joy of riding a bike at very great speeds in a bike race. And I'm delighted to welcome to the bike show Bill Strickland, an American journalist, senior editor at Bicycling magazine, and author of a clutch of cycling books, including a memoir of his own entitled 10 Points, which charts his quest to make a mark as an amateur bike racer. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jack. Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, 10 Points is a book that's about a lot more than bike racing and is all the better for that. But that's where I'm going to start. When did you enter your first bike race?
I grew up in the Midwest in Indiana, and a friend of mine were riding bikes, and we literally didn't know anyone else who rode. So we would kind of just ride around, and we finally found some wool shorts, and we finally found the kind of shoes we were supposed to have. And we thought we were entering these things that were races, but they were really just sort of like charity events. So, you know, that was when I was really young. Then I went to school, and we started racing around a little there. And then it just drops away. And I really got back into it and became a licensed racer later in life, like I think a lot of people do.
So how old were you when you got your racing license?
Well, I was mountain bike racing in the 90s. And then I got back into road racing really in about 2003, just the year before the book was written. I was 39.
And so that's older than you might expect to throw yourself into the bear pit of a bike race, even at an amateur level.
Well, it is typical in the U.S. A lot of masters racers, which is for the older racers, some of the most competitive categories, the guys who raced pro, they just kind of keep going and they show up at these neighborhood races and just make everyone cry. So it's a lot of older people in it. And it's just, you know, the level of competition as you get older is astounding.
So let's briefly explain the kind of racing that you talk about in the book. This is criterium racing, crit racing, going round and round on a fairly short road circuit in a bunch. It's not time trialing. And there's a point scoring system that applies throughout the race. So it's not just the winner at the end of the race.
Right. Some crits, it's really American form of racing. The courses are never more than a mile long, sometimes shorter. Often a lot of four corner crits, often more though, a lot of turns. The one that I wrote the book about and still participate in almost every Thursday is a points race. Every three laps, you sprint for points. It goes 5-3-2-1, 5 points for first, then 3-2-1.
And so can you remember your first Thursday night crit race and tell us how that felt?
Yeah, well, it was very intimidating. I live near the Lehigh Valley Velodrome, which is sort of known worldwide. And Marty Nostein, the Olympic gold medalist, that's his home track. And Bobby Lee, one of our Olympians, lives here. And a whole bunch of domestic pros and some guys who go to continental teams. And sort of the Kiwis come over here to train at our track because it's their winter. So they like to come here. A lot of people from South America, sort of these sites, South Africa, you know, people from all over the world come here and train. So the level of rider is extremely high, and they're just out there on Thursdays, sort of doing their workouts or playing around. And when amateurs like me, when I get in there, it's, you know, it's all I can do just to hang in with those guys. And it's very intimidating. I remember thinking about it for months and months and months before I decided whether to go try to do this thing.
And so how physically prepared were you? What kind of level were you at when you entered your first race? And how well did that prepare you for what the race was actually like?
Well, I was pretty fit. I was at the time, it's starting to go into the content of my book a little bit. I was at the time riding, as a lot of people will do, to sort of keep something at bay, or to, you know, to wear yourself out so you can be a kind of a normal human being. And this had reached, it had reached sort of a critical point where I felt like I was really fighting this kind of war with myself, and I was riding a lot to sort of make myself human. And I was about the fittest I'd ever been in my life. We have a training race here every Sunday, a training ride every Sunday that ends up being sort of an informal race on open roads. And I'd been doing pretty good in that. And I decided to show up on Thursday. And I was plenty fit enough to hang in there. But, you know, these guys, they're throwing elbows and they're bumping hips. It's very, very physical racing here because of the track. So you have to really be ready to ride with someone's head just, you know, laying on your shoulder the whole time, or bumping handlebars. There's a lot of chopping here. Some of it's dirty. Most of it isn't dirty. But it's very, very physical. And I wasn't at all ready for that. And I just, you know, I was scared. I went out the back. I didn't even want to be in the pack there.
Well, you describe the races beautifully in the book. And it's unusual the way you describe them also, because we tend to be accustomed to reading accounts of people who win bike races, not the people who are suffering at the back end of the field, just trying to hang on. But the races are just one of three scenes, if we can call them that, in kind of theatrical terms, which the events of the book take place in. And the other two are your childhood and your adult family life with your wife and daughter, the here and now. And the book tells the story of how these three parts of your life, parts of who you are, relate to one another. It's fair to say you had a pretty tough upbringing, a very tough upbringing, and more than what you might call the school of hard knocks, but you suffered very serious abuse, physical and mental violence at the hands of your father. That is something that you alluded to earlier. How does that link to your relationship with the bike?
Well, what's been surprising with people who read the book is everyone who connects with the book, and I think I would say most people who care passionately enough about bikes to say, to maybe listen to this show, it's more than just a bike to all of us. It's a part of who we are, and we use it for a lot of, you know, we use it to express ourselves, and we use it to cure ourselves, and we use it just for fun sometimes, as much as we use it to get around. And what has surprised me after I put the book out there was how many people have come up to me and said, me too, something, you know, that I'm something like that happened to me, or I can really identify with that. Now, there's varying degrees, you know, everyone can look back in their childhood or their past and remember a time when life was bad for them. And so, you know, you can go from 0 to 100 on that. There were people who had it worse than me. And people who had it not as bad as me, and people who had a really good life, but there was just something that they were dissatisfied or unhappy about. And it's striking how universal it is that people who come to the bike and deeply love the bike have something in their lives that they're working out with pedaling. It's been astounding to me and very eye-opening.
Because I can relate to the way in which there's a sort of meditative, mind-clearing aspect of riding the bicycle. You know, after an hour or so, I find that whatever it is that I've been worrying about in the day, in my day-to-day life, you know, it just seems a long way away from where I am right there on the bike. And I really appreciate that. And that's a kind of could call that a kind of meditation or kind of therapy, I suppose. But then racing, that's a different kind of thing, a different kind of abstraction. I've not raced a bicycle apart from in a few triathlons in my 20s, I confess to. There's the meditative aspect of training, which I think a lot of people can relate to, of not even training, just spending time on the bike as a way of getting away from something and a sort of stillness that you achieve on the bike. But in a race, there's a lot else going on, and it's kind of a slightly violent, difficult place to be in. How do you find that to be something that is healing?
I find it violent and beautiful. You know, you got to suffer in a bike race. And as soon as you think you've suffered as much as you can, you end up suffering a little more. And you look around and there's someone who hurts even worse and they're doing better than you. So it's very humbling. You're out there and you feel like you're undergoing this sort of noble test of fire where you're just, you know, you're quite the sight for all the world to marvel at. And you look over and everyone feels the same way and someone's going faster. So it's very humbling, and those feelings, all the feelings that I got from the pack of getting and giving violence and suffering, and this trust that racers have between each other, we're really trying to just make each other quit. We're trying to destroy each other, but at the same time, there's this level of trust that you're not going to do anything stupid. And you know, as you're going very fast, you have to really trust that the guy's just not going to move over and take your wheel out. So all of these feelings for me were a way to kind of dredge up everything from my past and just kind of understand the part I had played in it and the parts when I hadn't played in it. When, you know, in a race, sometimes you can attack and you can affect some part of the race. I rarely line up thinking I have a chance to win. I always look for a moment when I can affect the race or when I can contribute something to the outcome or when I can make somebody quit or help somebody win. For me, that's what racing is about at the level I can achieve. And so I thought back to my life. What were those moments where I could have done something? And what were those moments when no matter what I did, things were just happening to me? And the most you can do is try to survive them as best as you can. You know, try to hang on, try not to get dropped. It helped me understand who I was, good and bad.
Because you were, maybe you still are, fearful of becoming your dad. I mean, that's a fear that I think anyone is familiar with. You know, we're all slightly terrified as we get a bit older of becoming our parents. And particularly if you're a guy, to become the worst aspects of your father. Or I suppose if you're a woman, to become the worst aspects of your mum. That must have been a particularly difficult fear for you to handle, especially with a daughter of your own.
Yeah, it was. I was my daughter was 4 at the time that I started all this. The reason the book is named 10 Points is that I scored a 1 point in the race toward the end of the first year, 2003. And my daughter just said to me, you know, as kids will do, she was like, "Dad, I bet you score 10 points next year." And I made a promise to her that I would, which was ridiculous. There was no way I was going to score 10 points. But I made this promise, and so I decided I was just going to take a year of my life and throw myself into this to see if I could do it. I had this idea, which of course is incorrect, that if I scored 10 points, I would sort of kill any chance that I would be my father. Now, you know, as it turns out, I'm not him, which is what I've learned. And I learned that from, strangely enough, I learned that from failing to score 10 points. It's not a fear I have anymore, but I was at the time, I remember being, you know, literally terrified that this like thing was going to rise out of me, this sort of beast, and I could do to my family what he had done. I just walked around always sort of waiting for that to happen. And just every time I got angry over just sort of normal things, I could sort of feel this thing inside me trying to get out. And I was desperate to not let that happen.
So you set yourself this target of scoring the 10 points in a season, which by the standards of some riders in the pack is a very modest target. They would be scoring many dozens of points in a single race. But it's a target, as you said, that quickly seems entirely unsurmountable. But one thing that I was struck with is that you wanted to score those points by yourself, kind of without the aid of informal teammates or fellow riders. But you're a cycling journalist, you're a student of the sport, and you know that that goes against the way that bike racing works. And for someone immersed in the rituals of bike racing, I found that kind of baffling that you wanted to do it alone. I mean, you seem to have the attitude more of a time trialist than a road racer, which is all about cooperation within competition. Did I interpret something wrong there? Or?
No, you're correct. I actually thought of myself more as an opportunist that year. For some reason, it was important for me to do it alone. And I think it was, you know, it was embarrassing just to, you know, tell people I was going for 10 points. And I didn't want to talk about why. You know, I would say, oh, my daughter asked me to. And, you know, that's kind of weird. Even if, you know, the simplest explanation is a little weird to show up and tell a bunch of racers. And I also didn't know, I knew these guys, but I didn't know them very well. The top racers, the really good guys. And they didn't really trust me. And I was just intimidated by them. They were very, you know, they would run you off the road or bump you out of the pack. They wouldn't let you be at the front. And so my choices were to do it alone or to have a bunch of teammates who were essentially the same as me. I didn't want to do that. Now it's funny. I know all these guys. I'm friends. There's a character in the book, The Animal, who's just about the scariest, you know, as in the world of the book, he's like Lord Voldemort or something. And I'm friends with the guy now. And, you know, he comes over, we have dinner, I ride with him all the time. And when I'm at the crit now, these guys, I'm kind of like their cute mascot, you know, like when I attack, they're like, oh, look, there goes Bill. That's funny. And sometimes they'll help me, you know, they'll give me lead outs and they'll get me to the line. And I scored 10 points. Well, this year I only raced like five times, but I sort of routinely score a lot of points now. It's not that big of a deal, which is, you know, kind of funny to me looking back 10 years.
I was struck in Charlie Wigalius's book. I don't know whether you've had a chance to read that, Domestique.
Yes.
He describes the professional peloton as being like a multilingual school playground, a kind of schoolyard. It seems like that might be true also for you know, amateur racing, in the same sort of way that you've kind of got to find your place within the unwritten hierarchy of the schoolyard.
Right. And at the race I happen to do, it's an open race. And so I'm there with guys who are going to the Olympics and national champions and a few pros. And a lot of these guys, and so there are some women too, some great women pros there. They just don't want you up at the front because they don't trust you. They're not going to let an amateur come in and do something stupid and ruin their season. So it's very, you know, very hard to break into that place where they know you and trust you. And it's intimidating too. It's much more pleasant to sit at the back of the race and give it a shot and sort of suffer a little bit and try and tell yourself, you know, you did a really good job and that's the best you can do. But to try to get up there in the front, it's like an apprenticeship is the way I thought of it.
So what would be your tips 10 years on for someone who's maybe thinking at the age of 39 that they fancy chancing their hand at bike racing? They don't have to be 39. They could be younger or older. But if someone wants to start racing, bunch racing as an amateur without having done it before, what kind of insights can you offer to make their adjustment to the scene a little bit easier?
I think the most important thing is to be humble. A lot of people have fitness because of coaching and power meters and Garmins and online coaches. The level of fitness is extremely high and much more higher than the level of knowledge. And I think if you show up to a race and you're just humble and you think of it, if you think of yourself as an apprentice and you just watch and soak everything up and find out, you know, you can, it's apparent who the good racers are. and just look at them and just do what they do and follow them around. There was a point at the book about halfway through, I hadn't scored any points. And I realized I was just trying these like sort of almost like show-off-y moves. I would just make these dashing attacks and they were always doomed to failure. That's kind of how my family had always been. You know, we'd always like make some sort of big show and then never really put any effort. And I finally realized what I needed to learn to do was learn to be a bike racer. And I just started relentlessly following people. I didn't, for about a quarter of the season, I didn't even try to score points. I just thought, I'm just going to follow people and try to understand what this thing is. And I could feel myself becoming part of the race. And it started to feel very natural to me. And I could tell when things were going to happen. At that point then, I started to have some of the understanding of the really good people. But of course, they're at a whole different fitness level. So then, as fit as I was, I could see things that were happening, but I still wasn't able to follow those people. But then when I got in with people who were my own ability, I started doing very well in races. So I think, especially if you're older, you have a big advantage because you have some patience and you know that it takes time to learn things and you're not going to go out and just, you know, be a jackass.
Bill, seeing you as you're on the line, I'm going to have to ask you about all the continuing fallout from the Lance Armstrong doping revelations in the professional sport. This is a story that must have been very tricky for you because for quite a long time you were among Lance's biggest cheerleaders in the media. You even went along with him on his comeback in 2009 and wrote a book about that.
Yeah, I had this sort of agnostic relationship with whether he had doped or not. You just would have had to been a fool to say there was no possibility that he doped. This was early on, I'm talking about before USADA. You know, there was just too many people saying things. But at the time, there had never been anyone who on the record would say, I actually saw him dope. So of course, you know, I always knew there was a possibility he had doped. And sometimes I thought there was a really good chance he had, but I also always had this little bit of doubt, like, you know, maybe he didn't. It's a cliche, but, you know, when he looks at you and he's looking right at you, he's a very charismatic guy in a way, when he's looking right at you and saying, I didn't dope, it does mean a lot. And I'd seen him in, cancer wards with kids. And so I had all this sort of, I knew he was an ass. It's plain that he was an ass to people. But I also I saw this other side of him. So I always thought he deserved sort of my doubt that he hadn't doped. And so even in the book, I write about the book when I followed him in his comeback. I write about his association with doping. But I said in there, I'm going to choose to think that there's a chance he didn't dope until more proof comes. Well, you know, of course, the proof came, and I actually had found out before USADA, about a year and a half, I found out without a doubt, I knew that he had doped, and it finally erased even like the littlest shred of doubt. And so I wrote a cover story for Bicycling saying he doped. We know it. There's no chance that he didn't. But I also said, by the way, I think he was still a great racer. So I took sort of the worst position possible, which was I said he doped, so everyone who supported him hated me, and I said I thought he was a great racer, so everyone who didn't like him hated me. So I had sort of a really fun year and a half of being told to go to hell by everyone.
Is that still the view that you hold of him?
It's more complex now. Do I think he was a great racer? Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, when you look at, sort of when he went around Beloki and rode through the field and got back on his bike. I mean, that sort of stuff is just insane. And I remember when he won the world champs when he was 21, and I saw him race here, and the guy was a great racer. And even if you talk to some like Vauders, you know, Floyd Landis and I have talked, and Floyd says, yeah, the guy was a badass on a bike. I don't even think the doping is the worst of it. I think it's the the toll that he took on people's lives just seems to me what's really unforgivable. I mean, as we all know now, the doping was just, if you made a decision that you wanted to contend, let alone win, if you wanted to contend in that era, or if you wanted to help someone who wanted to contend, you had to dope. Now, a lot of people made the decision that it wasn't worth it. And, you know, they just went home or they tried to scratch out a living however they could. But if you wanted to be a top rider, you had to dope. And I think people would give Armstrong a pass on the doping without all of the other, without the intimidation and some of the other potentially criminal things that he had done.
Do you think that we're now out of that era where you had to dope as a ticket to enter the contest?
Yeah, that's great. Right. That's a great question. I mean, look, guys are using, you know, there's a thing about finish bottles now, which guys are taking right before the end. There's tramadol in it, which is sort of a pain reliever, and caffeine. Tramadol is legal, so it's not doping. But look, it's a drug, right? These guys are taking a pain reliever for the final few kilometers of a bike race. Even Garmin has, you know, admitted to using these sometimes. I don't want to call it's not a doping culture, but it's a culture where you're going to supplement your performance however you can. And I think that is not going to go away. Do I think there's less EPO and less blood transfusion? Absolutely. You know, I think it's a farce that there were no positives in the Tour and no positives in the Vuelta. You know, I think that's just incorrect. And I think definitely people were doping for the Tour and the Vuelta. I don't know who. People certainly were. We shouldn't fool ourselves. I think sort of this turbocharged era where you see these inhuman performances, I think that's done, at least for a little while, until the next thing comes along.
Although there are people out there, particularly you'll find them on Twitter, who point to the speeds of the riders today, the top riders today, creeping up towards the turbocharged era again. Is that just the aggregation of marginal gains, or should we be suspicious on the level of performance?
Who knows? I mean, my view of racing, I've been through a lot since, you know, from being sort of a wide-eyed believer in Armstrong and then following him for his comeback and then saying that he doped and sort of, you know, going through that gauntlet. And I sort of look at the sport as kind of a circus or kind of entertainment now. And I'm less, my moral outrage is gone, I would say. And I want it to be a good show. My understanding is that whatever they're doing now for performance enhancement is not illegal. Like, it might be sort of creepy and it might be pretty far out there. You know, you look at these guys, they are really, really, really skinny, and yet they're putting out all kinds of power. And there's something not natural about that, but it doesn't mean that it's illegal. It means that, you know, they're just on to the next technique. And I would say we're fooling ourselves if we think genetic doping is not far away, or, you know, some sort of muscle enhancement, or, you know, shooting little nanorobots in to eat up lactic acid and improve performance. Like, this stuff's coming, and there's no stopping it. So we're going to look back and think about, you know, EPO and blood transfusion is going to seem quaint. We're going to be like, well, remember when all they did was inject their own blood? Wasn't that kind of old-fashioned and nice?
So that suggests to me that you don't think there's a huge amount of value in truth and reconciliation, because we're essentially in a continuous process where it's not going away. We're just going to maybe get better at detecting it in certain respects, and then people will move on to the next thing. It's kind of like an ever-ending arms race. So what's the point of truth and reconciliation? I mean, or what's the point of even professing to be a clean and transparent team?
Well, I think there are clean and transparent teams. I mostly believe Garmin. You know, like, I would say now at this point in my life, I say you never know, but I believe Vauders is trying to do it right, and I would believe, you know, I think those riders ride clean at Garmin. That is to say, they don't use any banned substances.
And do you think they ought to confess what they've done in the past?
You know, I wrote a whole book where I confess like every not every. Most of the lousy things I'd done, and it was really hard, and it didn't, you know, I'm not sure what I gained. I think the point of truth and reconciliation is we just need to come to terms with that era, and I think that's okay. But I don't know that it needs to be this long, drawn-out process. I think we can all just sort of look at each other and be like, well, yeah, okay, they all doped. You know, let's carry on. My problem with it is kind of, it's a bit hypocritical, you know, so we're stopping it at, what did they say, 98 or 99? I mean, let's, like, look, Miguel Indurain, he doped with EPO, right? Like, he's never admitted it. He's never going to. I don't think he should have to, but we all know it. It's, you know, when you look and think about it, it's obvious. We all know, you know, the guys, that was probably about when EPO and blood transfusion really became popular. We all know the guys before that. Not all of them, but a lot of them were taking amphetamines or cortisone, or we know it. I don't know that it's not going to help me to get all the details.
I mean, is there a kind of problem here for a media which is dependent on the sport being perceived as, you know, healthy and kind of wholesome, which has always been the way in which the sport has presented itself to the general public? Of course, the people on the inside, you know, no different, and maybe the fans, dedicated fans, no different. But if the media were to just accept that doping is a part of cycle sport, and I suppose doping is a part of athletics, other endurance sports, soccer, baseball, does that not present a economic problem for the media? Because in this day and age, it seems as though people are less interested, or it's off-putting to them to feel that there is this doping side of the sport. I mean, I've certainly heard that sponsors of bike racing in the United States have decided that they're going to put their sponsorship money elsewhere, and there have been races that no longer are held, professional races, because the sponsors are just thinking, you know what, this is a sport that's just mired in scandal. We want to spend our marketing budget on something else.
We are the most proactive sport. You know, we are right now, I would say cycling is the cleanest professional sport in the world, you know, probably including ping pong even. And the story hasn't been told, like, it hasn't been told in the good way that, like, look, we're cleaning up, we're trying to do this. It's been told as like a series of scandals. And I think that's just, you know, I don't know who's responsible for that. That's just the way it happens. I don't think the media should just accept the doping. You know, I think guys like Paul Kimmage and David Walsh, I think those guys are great. And to me, it adds to tension to the sport where it should be clean, but it's not. And it can't be, you know, these guys can't do that. I sort of like, as I said before, just kind of the whole circus aspect of it. I certainly don't think, you know, the media should be complicit and just not report that these guys are doping. I don't think neither should we pretend that, you know, Lance was the devil and now we've sent him back down to hell and everything's going to be okay. I would hope we continue to take a really clear-eyed look at what's going on today and just report it and let the public figure it out. I think we, more so than media, I think we as fans are trying to figure out how to live with the sports we love and what it means to us and what matters, the performance or this idea we have of purity. And, you know, for me at the amateur level, that's where I go out and I get that really pure essence of competition. When I watch the pros, these guys are trying to win, you know, it's for the same reason, politics is not just issue based, you know, when someone wants to become the president of the United States, they're just going to try to destroy the other person however they can. They're not, you know, we're not going to sit down and sort of just present the issues and in a really objective way decide who has the best plan. Someone wants to win and they're going to go to whatever means they can to get that victory.
Do you think that we'd actually be better off with just amateur sport? Do you think sport should be professional?
I love professional sports. I mean, these guys are great. These guys are the best in the world. I've been very lucky to be able to hang around and ride on their rest days and easy days with a fair amount of professional riders, you know, like upper end guys, you know, winners of classics and this and that. And these guys are astounding. And I would never, you know, they should be rewarded for not just hitting the genetic lottery, but the guys who get to the top have a real mix of determination and courage and, you know, maybe a little stupidity, which I admire, and this other, you know, knowledge, not just genetic talent, but they know how to race. And I love pro sports, but I just think it's something sports are different now. I think we as fans have to figure out how to take in sports and what they should mean to us. That's what is changing, I believe.
And do you think there's a role there for the sports governing body? Pat McQuaid lost his job largely as a result of the Lance Armstrong revelations. And there's now a new guy, Brian Cookson, former head of British Cycling, in charge there. What would you like to see him do?
I think all institutions, you know, look, I remember when I was in student council in grade school, you know, I think like the treasurer was stealing money from the M&M fund, you know, our candy fund, our Smarties fund. Look, I think, you know, institutions are kind of to various levels corrupt just by the fact that they're institutions. And I think that's never going to change either. You know, that said, I think Cookson is fresh. He seems very forthright. He seems like he's going to take an honest job at cleaning up the things. I don't think the governing body should be in cahoots with the top riders. I think there needs to be separation between the governing body and the testing agencies. I think he's going to take care of all those things. I like that he's very focused on women's racing, which I think is almost every women's race I've ever seen has been really exciting, and almost no one watches. So I'm excited that, you know, he's going to see where he can take that. I think it's going to be better, but it just, look, John F. Kennedy, who was one of the greatest American presidents, was kind of a, you know, not a nice guy. I think that's just the way it goes once you reach a level of power. And I don't think we should expect perfection from our institutions.
Well, I know there's one issue above all that you'd like to submit a memo to the desk of Brian Cookson and maybe all the other team owners in the sport. And this relates to a critical issue for the future of the sport, which is the headgear that professional cyclists wear before and after their races, particularly when they're on the podium after doing well in a race.
Yeah, look, if Cookson can come through with this, getting cyclists to wear cycling caps on the podium instead of baseball hats, then I'll do everything. You know, I'll send the guy all the money he needs for his next campaign. Last year, I don't know how this started. Someone, I guess a few people noticed this at once. I think it was maybe this guy, Cyclocosm on Tumblr and Twitter, or Cycling Inquisition. I forget. Someone started talking about riders wearing baseball hats on the podium. And I believe it was me, I'm not sure, coined the hashtag caps, not hats. And last year during the tour, it started to get a lot of traction. And it seemed like it suddenly became this sort of grassroots thing where a lot of fans wanted to see cycling caps, wanted to see the racers wearing cycling caps instead of baseball hats. Mark Cavendish, as part of the Quickstep team, was wearing a cap, and he spoke about caps, not hats. And so, yeah, cycling is a sport about tradition and heritage and this sort of the classic elements. And it's also a weird sport, you know. It has its quirky corners and all these strange customs. And the cycling cap is one of those. And it bothers me to see a baseball hat up on the podium, you know, as much as it would if the New York Yankees came out onto the field wearing hockey jerseys or you know, football jerseys. I think it's incorrect for cyclists to wear baseball hats.
Why did cyclists start wearing baseball hats in the first place? Where did this come from?
We have our best people working on this right now. We're conducting an investigation for a Caps and Reconciliation Committee. I believe it was the sponsors who wanted the broader billboard of the baseball hat up front. And I, you know, we're trying to track it down to find the first rider who wore a baseball hat on the podium. We, you know, right now we're back to 1989. So I don't want to reveal the name yet. It seems premature until we alert the rider in person.
Okay. Well, they'll be hauled before the grand jury.
Well, I don't want him to learn it through the media. I'd rather call it first.
Well, that's very honourable. I'm sure Jonathan Vaughters would approve of that. I've got my copy of the rules by the Velo Minardi in front of me. And Rule 22 says cycling caps are for cycling. Obviously, it endorses your view that baseball caps have no place in cycling. But one shouldn't wear a cycling cap all the time, you know, just because you have this garment. It's a garment, according to these guys, it's a garment that you should wear, you know, maybe just a little bit before the ride and maybe a little bit after, but certainly not once you've changed out of your cycling gear. You don't wear it down to the pub.
For me, you know, I think the Velo Minardi rules are cool, but there's like 90 something rules now or something, like, you know, I think those guys are great, but they need to you know, rule one should be there shouldn't be too many rules. I think people should do whatever they want. For me personally, yeah, the farther I am from my bike, the stupider the cap looks. So, you know, I think that's a good rule. If you're touching your bike, you can wear anything that has to do with cycling. And then the farther you get from it, the worse and worse it looks. There's a field of appropriateness that surrounds your bike, and you need to stay within that when you're in cycling gear. Unless you're, you know, the podium's a whole different deal.
Well, that's very good advice. Bill Strickland, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much for your time. People can follow your happenings on Twitter, your True BS on Twitter, and in Bicycling Magazine, where you have a column. Is that a monthly column?
Well, I stopped the print column, and I still do a weekly column on the a website.
A weekly column on the website. Great. Well, thanks for your time, Bill.
Thanks for having me. And caps, not hats, search the hashtag and do what you can out there to wear your cap.
I was in conversation with Bill Strickland, and his book, 10 Points, which I highly recommend, is published by Hyperion. That's it for the Bike Show. And that's it for the Bike Show this season. In fact, that's it for the Bike Show 2013. Thanks for listening. It's been a short autumn season, and I'll be back again with more two-wheeled radio in the new year. Until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
And the weather today, dry and witty indoors with some light to moderate inversion. Tonight, the heat will cause increasing resonance with a high of 104.4, so expect good weather towards the weekend.